The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, I'm Alex Hearn, and welcome to a special edition of Tech Weekly, which arguably is not about tech, but technically is. Confused? Intrigued? Well, that's why this week we dedicate the show to the technology of cardboard and colour, to the lo-fi and highly imaginative technology that is the board game. Joining me to discuss the resilience of the board and its recent resurgence are Ellie Gibson, games writer and co-founder of the Scummy Mummies podcast. Welcome, Ellie.
Hello.
Owen Duffy, journalist and founder of the Unplugged Games Club and unofficially the Guardian's Glasgow correspondent. Great to have you down the line, Owen.
Hi there.
And arcade gaming expert, games reviewer and contributing editor of Develop magazine, Will Freeman. Huge welcome to you, Will.
Thanks very much. Hello.
Now, the popularity of board games has been a snakes and ladders style rise and fall, but they've never gone away. I'd like to ask the three of you, starting with Will, why you think that is? Where's that resilience come from?
I guess there's an accessibility to board games, which a lot of things like computer games initially suffered from. You know, it's a fairly immediate idea that's easy to comprehend, and they bring people together. That's not always a nice experience with video games. Board games, I guess we've all been there on those Christmas Day afternoons and so on. But bringing families together can be a dangerous business. But yeah, games are social. Of board games are social and accessible.
Should we be looking at video games as something to do with this cycle? Did they kill them and are board games now fighting back? Or is that too simplistic, Ellie?
I'm not sure. I think video games have always sort of... There's always been a hardcore market for video games. And yeah, we had the sort of casual video game sort of revolution with the Wii coming out a few years ago. And it's great that board games are popular again now, but I'm not sure how linked the two things are. I think board games, for me, as well as the accessibility, like Will said, it's about sort of creating stories sometimes within your family. You know, I'm sure we've all got stories of a particular board game that was hugely fun and hilarious or absolutely awful. And, you know, I once ended up tearing a piece of Monopoly money into three pieces. Everyone's got a story like that, you know. And I think that's really what explains their sort of long-term appeal.
And Owen, I mean, have you seen this rise at the Unplugged Games Club, or for you, has it been consistently a part of your life and a part of the life of the people you play with?
Yeah, well, certainly. We seem to be in a dramatic upswing for the hobby. I mean, when I speak to some of the distributors of games, they talk about a rise in sales of up to 40% year on year, which to me seems pretty incredible. And I think that one of the reasons for that is just that the games themselves are getting better. We're seeing new designers coming through. We're seeing, you know, innovative new ways of play that use a lot of the social elements that you get when you get people sat around a table. So I think certainly that is bringing new people into the hobby. It's giving them an experience that in many cases video games can't.
I mean, those new games, this is something... It's the stereotype, but when a lot of people hear board games, they'll think of Monopoly, Cluedo and Scrabble. What you're saying is that there's a whole world of new games, that it's not just 100-year-old classics that people are playing.
Absolutely. There's, a real thriving, independent, smaller scene of designers and publishers who are bringing out some really innovative games. And again, to make the comparison to video games, where you have every year a number of big AAA titles coming out, which are iterations of previous things, whether that be Grand Theft Auto or Tomb Raider or Call of Duty. I know, as a board game player, that every month there are going to be two or three titles that give me something completely new that I have never experienced before. It's a bit of a golden age, really.
Do you find those titles through the community, or are there certain designers that you follow?
There's certainly some word-of-mouth buzz, and there are sites online such as Board Game Geek, which is a big one, where people discuss new games that are coming out. But yes, certainly there are designers that I follow. Some of my favourites are guys like Donald X. Vaccarino, who's made a number of really influential games, guys like Richard Garfield, who designed Magic the Gathering, one of my favourite games. So you really get kind of emerging stars of design coming through in the industry.
I mean, Will, are there people that you want to jump in and name check as well?
I was just going to say, as well, in terms of finding board games, and yeah, there's certainly board game designers that are worth following. And but at the same time, this new type of board game, although many listeners who know them would argue many of them have been around a good long time now, but terms like Euro-style or strategy games or serious games or the slightly snobby proper board games, these games are starting to be available on the high street in the UK now. So websites like Board Game Geek are invaluable, and there's great board game podcasts and so on, but you can go into WH Smith's, Waterstones, other high street retailers are available, and at least get the tip of the iceberg of these games. They're starting to be stocked on the shelves of normal shops alongside Monopoly and Scrabble and the kind of older family games, which maybe attract a bit of snobbery from those into proper board games.
Naming is always an important thing. I mean, if proper games is snobby, but at the same time you do want to say that you're talking about something that's not just the classic family games, what do you say? How do you phrase it?
I don't know. I don't know if I like serious games, to be honest. It seems a bit of an oxymoron.
I feel similarly
that
cautious.
That doesn't sound like the most fun. I'm not sure that it needs to be put in a separate box. I think that's a bit elitist almost. It's like, you know, I think there are different types of games and we can enjoy them and at different times. You know, I want to play a really simple lotto game maybe with my little son, and then when he goes to bed I want to drink several bottles of wine and play Carcassonne with my dad, you know, and I don't distinguish between those. In the same way with video games, actually. I play Candy Crush, which is a casual game, but I also might play Tomb Raider, which is considered a hardcore game, and I don't think of myself as a gamer who belongs in one of those boxes.
And I think maybe that is kind of reflected by the trend at the moment that they are becoming one of the same things. I agree, there is a snobbery, and I've probably been guilty of it myself before in terms of getting into contemporary strategy games. But at the same time, now the places are stocking the games alongside one another, and you do find board game nights where people that would call themselves serious board game fans will play casualer games and more serious games. Diversity is a real strength of the board gaming industry, and perhaps that diversity has finally got to a point where a wide variety of games are meeting the same audience, the mass audience.
How do board games, I mean, Will, Ellie, and I think Owen, you're all also into video games. How do they sit alongside video gaming in your lives?
For me, board games are quite, well, because video games is my job as well. You know, board games are quite a nice antidote to that. And I don't play a lot of online video games, partly because I am a lady and it's not a fun place to be if you're me quite a lot of the time. Whereas with board games, you know, my brother calling me a rude word is an entirely different scenario, and I can cope with that.
And reach across the table to give him a punch.
Yeah. And I have occasionally reviewed some of the crossover titles. That I remember a few years ago, I reviewed Hasbro Family Game Night, which is like Mr. Potato Head and Monopoly and all these games on one Wii disc. And it was awful, to be quite honest. I think I gave it 2 out of 10. It was really terrible. And it sort of missed the point for me of board games are about sitting round together and interacting. And video games, I sort of more often play on my own, and it's quite a different form of entertainment for me.
So they complement each other.
I think, yeah, they can complement each other. There's definitely, of course, they have similar characteristics and there's a lot of trends that you see in both of them and stuff. But, I, again, I'm not sure, you know, trying to mix them together always works that well.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, I do play some video games, but I would say that board games have, to some extent, replaced them in my life at the moment. I have a young son, I have quite a busy job, and I don't get that much time to sit in front of a console or the computer and just have time to myself. So having something that I can do socially, whether it's with my family, with my friends, with the gaming group that I run, is fantastic, because it means that you're getting that play experience, but you're also spending time in the company of other people.
At the same time, technology has influenced board games, hasn't it? I mean, speaking from my own experience, I love playing tablet versions of a couple of the games that I haven't been able to afford physically. I love games like Hearthstone, which take the experience of a board game and complement it in ways that you couldn't do with paper. I mean, Will, is that helping drive adoption of this
medium? Yeah, I think it is. Particularly the tablet board games or translations of board games, Ticket to Ride, Settlers of Catan and Carcassonne, kind of the big three gateway drugs to board gaming, are all have great tablet versions. They're affordable. They let you test the water. They come with an interactive tutorial, which is a lot more friendly than being greeted with a kind of rule book to learn and introduce other players to. So there's certainly, I think tablets and video games have certainly helped with board games and board games acceptance. And I guess that's also part of just the kind of rise of geek culture as kind of something that's suddenly admirable and fashionable and that kind of thing. But as well, I would say that board games have a huge influence over the design of video games, including those that wouldn't look in any way like a board game. In fact, the way I started getting into these modern board games was as a video games journalist, going to visit lots of game developers, and I just started to notice on shelves in the backgrounds of offices these piles of the same games, Ticket to Ride and so on, games like that, and started to ask developers, and game developers were having board gaming nights where they'd perhaps be playing board games and just learning about balancing the numbers behind a game, balancing luck and odds and the maths that might be equally important to a fast-paced action FPS. So yeah, there's a kind of way that video game developers and designers are looking to the systems inside board games to influence video game design. So it's a two-way process, the influence on one another.
Do you think that's a good description of Ellie, that it's video games stripped down to their barest essentials? I mean, if you're trying to convince someone who plays a lot of video games to give board games a try, is that how you'd pitch it?
Yeah, I think, as Will says, it works both ways. And if you look at, I'm trying to think of games, that one of my favourite games of all times is Advance Wars on the DS, which is basically a board game. It's a strategy game, it's turn-based, you've got a little army and you've got to defeat the other little army. And it's just really good fun. And I would say to any gamer who's enjoyed a game like that, well, you're playing a board game already, you know, and the difference is, of course, that with a board game, you're sitting in a real room with real people, and that is a different kind of fun. But yeah, give it a go.
That real room aspect, many of us, when we meet up with our families, feel like we're going back to square one. And the board game's a way to communicate without thinking about it too much. I mean, why are the classic board games still so familiar at Christmas and New Year? Why is there anything we can get our families to switch to from that?
I like a good old-fashioned, slightly annoying, boring board game myself. I feel like it's a well-known psychological phenomenon that we do regress when we go home for Christmas and stuff. We do become the people that we were 10, 20 years ago, and board games is a part of that. And for me, growing up, board games, part of why I enjoyed them was about releasing tension and acting out rivalries and, yeah, maybe scoring the odd point, you know. And let's not pretend we're all grown-ups now and everybody loves each other. You know, we do most of the time, but I think it's fun, and I think sometimes it's nice just to sit down and play a game where everybody knows the rules, everybody knows the rows they're going to have about the rules, and just sort of enjoy it in the same way you enjoy the same Christmas movie or you eat turkey every year, or it's about tradition as much as anything.
I was going to say those classics persist because they've become the ritual of many people's family lives, but at the same time, I think, you know, and certainly, you mentioned they're learning the rules. That is a real challenge for a lot of new board games, is you've got to find a group of people that not only want to play a board game with you, but are willing to listen to you talk about rules. But certainly, and I keep mentioning those kind of classic gateway board games, Ticket to Ride is a fantastically easy to teach game. And things like that, I'm sure, could be very much become part of a great and argument-filled Christmas day or any other time you're forced to spend time with your family.
Owen, do the classics have a place in your life still?
Yeah, well, I find myself agreeing with Will there. I think that obviously there are games that have a tremendous deal of staying power, but I think that by the same token, there are games that kind of share elements with some of those classics and that you can introduce to people based on their existing preferences. For example, if someone likes a roll and move game like Snakes and Ladders or Monopoly, then there are games like Formula D, which is a motor racing game, or Camel Up, which is a game about betting on the outcome of camel races, which use some of the same mechanics that you can maybe use as a sort of wedge to bring in some new ideas to your Christmas ritual.
I mean, when a lot of people consider getting into whatever we decided is the best term, things which other people might call serious games or proper games, but which we're too refined to do, a lot of the things that will keep them out of that are ideas like huge rule manuals, massive boxes, countless components. What games don't have those problems? What are the exact opposite of the stereotype?
Well, sort of talking about a new tradition that we've developed recently. So we kind of have two Christmases. We have family Christmas with my mum and dad and all of that. And then we have urban family Christmas, where we have sort of 10 of our friends around who live in the local area. And we always, like, we have turkey and we do Secret Santa and then we play a game. And last few years, we've played Cards Against Humanity, because that is that's a great game to play with that many people. And it's very simple. There are no dice. There's no board. There's no faffing about. There's just cards and obscenity, basically. And we found that that works really well for us because, yeah, it's not complicated. And you can explain that game to someone in 60 seconds and they can play one round of it and that's it. That's kind of all they need to know. But again, because it's so simple, you can also make up your own rules and play with it and kind of evolve it to suit your particular group. So I think games like that, for me, are kind of what I enjoy most at the moment.
And there's certainly that term, to apply the term serious gaming, really misrepresents the diversity of board games there are at the moment. Sure, there are incredibly complicated ones that are very expensive and can take a hell of a lot of learning, and you know, you'll need 6-7 hours to play one game through. But at the same time, within serious gaming, there's some very silly, funny, playful ones. I mean, Dixit is a fantastic one, which has pretty much no symbols, no numbers, and it's just picture cards and lying to your friends and family, or at least kind of semiotic trickery to describe cards to trick people around you. And it ends up brilliantly funny, and the social dynamic of your group can really influence the way the game goes, from being very family relevant to very crude, for example. And the other thing I think it's saying, even from the more playful ones, the storytelling and creative ones, there's dexterity games. Terror in Meeple City is a great one, if anyone remembers. Crossbows and Catapults back in the kind of 80s, knocking down plastic castles. This is kind of the same with knocking down wooden skyscrapers, but with just enough strategy. But right through to the relatively heavier, more serious games, they are suitable for quite a wide age range. Lots of them, you can be surprised as you sit down with a kind of niece or nephew who absolutely trounces you despite being kind of, you know, a hell of a lot younger than you, and they're still suitable for a group of adults to play as a very serious board game. So, and I think that's the magic of a lot of these modern ones, is they are, as Owen said, they're getting better. Designers are learning more about how to make these games, and there are these games that can have that, you know, it's often used to market video games, that thing of quick to pick up, and there's a hell of a lot of depth there. So,
you know, the oldest serious game of all, if you like, is chess, which my dad taught me to play when I was like, you know, 6 or 7. Obviously I was not a prodigy. I'm still not very good at it, but it's quite complex in terms of learning all those different moves for every piece and castling and all of that stuff. But I managed to pick it up and then, you know, enjoyed it until I discovered Mousetrap and Twister, you know, realised there was more ways to have fun. But yeah, I think it's not a new thing. I think, as you say, well, you know, games that can be complex to learn, and that's fine, and you should, it's all right to trust children, I think, a bit to be willing to put the commitment and the focus in. Something's fun and they're spending time with you as a parent, then they'll do it.
I think the other thing to say about these games is a lot of them don't include Monopoly, for example. Famously, one thing is, it's apparently famously ruined by people introducing house rules, which upset the balance of it. But that has player elimination. It has people leaving the game with potentially an hour or hours to go. Whereas a lot of these board games, even when you're losing, modern board games, even when you're losing, there's lots going on and you stay in the game to the end and that kind of thing.
Owen, I mean, when you introduce people to board games, what do you do? How do you do it? Do you find, is there one game that you focus on as the best new player?
There's such a variety to board games, and there's such a variety to people's taste, that it's really a case of finding out what they're into and trying to tailor your suggestions to them. For example, if someone is into, say, a very light video game like Angry Birds or Candy Crush, then they might like some of the lighter, kind of more dexterity-based games like Click Clack Lumberjack, which is all about trying to knock down specific bits of trees with a plastic axe. They might like perhaps something like Zombie Dice, which is a simple kind of dice rolling game where you have to kind of push your luck and try to eat as many humans as possible. On the other hand, if they're into, you could look at the sort of themes of fiction that they enjoy. If they're into perhaps kind of fantasy TV programs, then they might be interested in a kind of fantasy story-oriented game like Dungeons & Dragons. So it's really a case of looking at the individual and trying to find the game that will appeal to them.
In London, there's just been quite a lot of fuss over the opening of Draughts, a board game cafe, and there's also the Scenario Bar in Stoke Newington, which does a similar thing. These are popping up all around the country. Is that a good place to go to get your fix?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that more and more of these places are opening up because a cafe is a social hub. These games provide a social experience. And if you're, you know, from a business perspective, if you can have someone sitting drinking coffee in your establishment for 3 or 4 hours rather than 30 minutes, it makes a hell of a lot of sense. I don't know what it is about Glasgow in particular at the moment, but there are a kind of huge number of these places opening relative to the population size as well.
Well, just backing up by saying it's a really great place to get into board games. You can try them out without having to invest in them. There'll be people there to teach you the rules, which, almost like anything with learning, having someone introduce you rather than teaching yourself is more fun and more efficient in terms of learning.
I sort of tried to set up a board game club like in my house, because again, with a small child, I don't get out much. So I was like, brilliant, I'll just make everyone come to my house. Yeah. And then I can simultaneously babysit and play games. And like my dad came around, a few friends, and we played Small World. And yeah. To be honest with you, we just couldn't really get our heads around it. The rules were massively, it's all races and resources, and it was really complex. And it went on for hours. I'm not sure anyone really enjoyed it that much.
Yeah, I guess there is that. You know, there are the board games nights that are at the Scenario Bar in London, in Dalston. And I'm sure there's many other great board game nights that other people would be able to recommend. But they're finding one where there are people to take you through the games is a good point. And I guess when you're looking up at the board game night, if they are providing board games, that probably suggests of a board games night people that will know what they're doing in terms of teaching you rules. Because, yeah, I too have tried to assemble friends and introduce them to a board game I don't know. And that can be, depending on the board game, it can be a slightly, an unfriendly introduction to board games. But yeah, if a board games night is providing the board games and fairly well established and has lots of attendees, they're signs that there'll be people there knowing what they're doing. And these days the board game industry provides a lot of board games to the board game nights, and thus you might even get professional demonstrators at the bigger board game nights.
We'll slide further into the serious gaming world shortly, but first a word from our sponsor.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
We've been talking a lot in generalities, but what I really want to hear from each of you is just one game which you think is a really good, really fun introduction, which you have loved and obsessed over, but at the same time, you'd recommend to a new player. Why do you love it? Who's it fun for? Who's it made for? Ellie?
I've wrote about this recently, but I'm going to say Risk, because for me it's sort of midway between a very sort of easy, simple game like Cluedo and the more complex board games we're seeing now, because it's quite simple to learn and it's little cards and plastic figures and there's a map and all of that. But you can get really deep with it and you can get really into sort of strategy. And I know there's quite a lot of snobbishness about it, I've noticed, because it is a very old game and people are like, oh, it's not really that good. But for me, that was the game I grew up playing, and that's the game I've had the most fun with in terms of interacting with other people, because it's really about diplomacy. And if you want, you can just roll the dice and do it all on chance. But the way we play it in my house, and also I was in a Risk club in my 20s. That's how cool I was. You don't see that in Sex and the City, do you? So I was in a Risk club. And we used to just get together and play this game. And like, I found the human interactions and the dynamics and the relationships and how the real life relationships would feed into that, sometimes in quite a negative but sort of thrilling way. I found that really exciting. So for me, that, you know, screw the snobs, that's my favourite game.
Have you played the second edition of it?
I haven't. I bought it for my brother recently for his birthday, and it's our Christmas. It's this Christmas's project.
Because I find that one quite interesting. I mean, I don't know if anyone else has played it, but it's very clear that they've taken a look at Risk, and as with all the best redesigns, they've thought about what the downsides are of it. The big one being that frequently a game of Risk ends with two players left. Everyone else has got bored, lost and wandered off, and they're just hurling armies against each other until a series of lucky dice rolls means that one of them wins. The new edition, which is essentially what you'll get if you buy Risk from the shops now, fixes that with an objectives system. You have three goals to do. When you've done them, you win the game, which can mean that they end on a slight anticlimax, but it also means that they end.
Yes, yeah.
Owen, what's your recommendation? What's the game you're passionate about right now?
Well, certainly for introducing people to the hobby, there's a game by a designer called Matt Leacock called Pandemic, which is all about a team of medics trying to eradicate 4 diseases from the world. It's a very tense game. It kind of ramps up the pressure as the diseases spread over the course of it. It's a cooperative game, which I think to a lot of people who maybe aren't necessarily into more competitive games, that can be quite an attractive proposition. You're working together rather than against each other. Also, every player has their own unique ability. You take on a role that lets you do certain things. So everybody kind of gets to be the star of the game at one point. You get to make that play that uses your character's unique special power to save the day and to let it go another turn and to stop the epidemics from winning.
Cooperative games are something we haven't really talked about much, but they're something that I find quite interesting because a lot of the times I've played a cooperative game, it's fallen into the same problem, which is that one player's played it more, one player thinks that they have the best strategy, and so they end up kind of playing the game alone by telling everyone else what to do.
That is that like marriage.
Is that a problem that you see, Owen? How do you solve it?
It can happen with Pandemic. I mean, particularly if you have one person who's more experienced, it's just a kind of case of self-control, not jumping in and saying, no, you don't want to do that, you want to do this. I think other games have an element of cooperation, but are kind of more team-based, or they have perhaps an element where one person is secretly a betrayer. There's one game called The Resistance Avalon, where half of the players will be on the side of King Arthur and the forces of good, and the other players will be minions of Mordred, and they have to work together, keep their identities hidden, but kind of cooperate in a sort of subtle way. So it adds that element of cooperation. It means that nobody's left kind of trying to complete objectives entirely on their own, but it means that nobody can really jump in and say, this is what you need to do at this time.
This is going to make me sound like the saddest person ever, but one of the nice things about some of the co-op games I've played is that you can play them single player, yeah. Which does have the advantage of, even if you don't know anyone who's played it before, you can still play it on your own, teach yourself the rules, and then have the friends around and not have the awkward 45-minute reading explanation of the rules before you even start playing.
Solitaire. I think we've all done it, and you know, people play single player video games and no one says that's sad, so I'm not sure why people would think that playing a cooperative game by yourself is some sort of laughable prospect.
Well,
yeah, I'll just to say single player co-op and solitaire games or games with solitaire modes are fantastic. The indulgence of laying out loads of cards and pieces in a board in front of you and having a cup of coffee and spending half an hour in that system and learning it is great. Mice and Mystics is a fantastic game that's a kind of co-op storytelling dungeon crawling game that is great to play single player. But to recommend a game for people getting into the hobby, I'm going to actually choose, I did briefly mention it before, Terror in Meeple City, which was until very recently called Rampage, but I think it was a little too similar to the arcade game Rampage. I don't know if anybody took objection, but the name was changed. So it's effectively a dexterity game, which means an action game. You and your friends, in setting it up, build a kind of cartoonish model city out of bits of cardboard and fill the tower blocks with little wooden people. And then you play various monsters trying to destroy the city and eat the most people. And the rules are quite smart in that it could be a very hectic game. To move, for example, you don't roll a dice, you flick a disc that bounces around the board and you end up where the disc is. To blow fire, you put your chin on the wooden dinosaur or wooden monster and blow to blow down tower blocks. There's flicking wooden vehicles around and stuff, but there's enough objectives and rules and punishments for unruly play, such as knocking too many pieces off the board, that actually you have to be very strategic and you have to be kind of very methodical in smashing a city to pieces. So it's a great balance of hilarious action and a little bit of thinking, not too many rules. And yeah, it definitely shows that the word serious games doesn't apply because it's very, very silly.
Something that's been really absent in all of this discussion are games with recognisable properties. If you walk into any board game shop or even just a high street store that sells board games, you'll see tons of video game, the board game, movie, the board game, TV show, the board game. Is this like the video games world? Should we just avoid them if they have a recognisable name?
I'd say not at all. Some of them are a bit bad. There was a Batman and DC Comics and Street Fighter deck building game I didn't particularly enjoy, but surprisingly, and I don't know why, in board games, a lot of the licensed IP stuff is really good. The Battlestar Galactica board game is one of the most well-regarded board games there is.
How does that work?
It works by having hundreds of pieces and taking quite a long time to play, and it is cooperative. But
If you turn out one of you's a Cylon, you get to lock them in the garden while you finish.
Yeah. There is that kind of thing to it. And the recent BioShock game was another quite complicated one, but a fairly good reinterpretation of BioShock Infinite. There's a Star Trek deck building game, which kind of sees you assembling the crew and abilities of your ship. And that's actually quite light and easy to learn. So, yeah, I found a surprise. I don't know why, but board games seem to be able to get it right with IP.
I remember with great fondness the Neighbours board game.
Oh, right.
Did you ever play
different
that?
Different IP.
Oh, that was a big highlight of the early 90s.
I mean, that we're talking 3 hours, 300 pieces, incredibly thick rulebook.
Yeah. It's incredibly difficult. Yeah, there's a lot of elves in it. That's a nightmare. Spaceships. Yeah, no. That in my childhood, that was like, wow, that, because it was sort of like, I think it was a bit like Monopoly, but you were obviously on Ramsey Street, so you could go to the watering hole and Lasseter's, very exciting. And then it had like trivia questions. And obviously, as like a sort of 10-year-old girl, I did know what the B-side was of Jason Donovan's Too Many Broken Hearts. So I was a whiz at that game. I think they should bring that back, re-release it.
I think I was playing Dream Phone back then.
Oh, Dream Phone! Oh, I always wanted Dream Phone. Did you have it?
They've brought it back with a kind of, I think it's kind of got a plastic mobile phone now, or it's probably just an app, but it still exists.
That is something that I'm seeing more and more, is board games which have some little technological aspect of it which isn't a gimmick. I mean, I'm playing right now the XCOM board game, which comes with an app which kind of controls the pacing of the game for you. It senses if you're doing well and throws more things at you. It senses if you're doing badly and holds off a bit, or sometimes leans in to just give you too much stuff and deliver the killing blow. Are they just this decade's dream phone, or is that actually a trend that we're going to see more, Owen?
I think that's a really exciting development. I think that it opens up a whole range of possibilities. One is that you could have board games with downloadable content. So when you've finished the scenarios or the missions that come with the game, perhaps you can go and download 5 or 10 more and just expand the lifetime of that game in your collection. In board games, there's already a culture of people bringing out expansions and add-ons as physical products, but this means that it just makes it much easier to get that content onto your table.
Ellie.
Yeah, we'll see, really. I don't know, because I'm sort of, I've been burned by this sort of thing in the past. Like, do you remember another 90s classic, Atmosphere?
Yeah.
F-E-A-R. Yeah, and it came with a VHS cassette, which was very exciting. Mm, and it had like this hooded sort of demon who would be like, "You have rolled a 6. Fast forward the VHS to 3 minutes." And you would, and it was quite spooky and it was quite scary. But I think I played it once, and then, once you see the videos, the video. So I don't know.
There's potentially, I guess, a danger in board games work because of their simplicity, because of the kind of tactile nature of the parts, because that accessibility I first mentioned perhaps comes from the fact that people are fairly comfortable with being introduced to cardboard and bits of plastic. I mean, I'm really kicking myself that the name has totally escaped me. There's been a recently board game release that has a burning candle in the centre of the board and uses shadow and light.
Shadows in the Woods, I think.
Thank you, Owen. There are still, there's plenty of opportunity for great new ideas, introducing new things into board games. But in a way, the simplicity, the technical simplicity is perhaps part of the reason they work, especially socially.
Ellie, when you were talking about playing online video games, you said you didn't want to do it, partially because you're a woman and it's an awful place to be as a woman. Is somewhere like a board games cafe something that you think you'd feel more comfortable in, or are you worried that those attitudes carry over offline?
I think I would go to a board games cafe because, if I had time, because that's one of the problems with the internet, is that people will say the most awful things they wouldn't say to your face, and I would definitely feel a lot safer in an environment where, let's be honest, full of, geeks in nice shirts, not talking about present company, obviously. I would go to a board game cafe. I think it sounds fun.
Owen, I mean, Are we on the cusp of a trend here? Are we saying that 2015 is going to be the year of the board game, or have we kind of just plucked this out of the air?
I would certainly hope that we're on the cusp of a, a kind of wider recognition of board games. I think that the sales figures certainly suggest that they're becoming more and more popular. And also there's this kind of growing online community of people discussing games, discovering games. I think it's very encouraging. The board gaming industry continues to be dwarfed by the video games industry, but I think that because there is that kind of social, kind of real face-to-face element, it just offers something that you can't get anywhere else.
And what are the problems that it needs to overcome before it can actually, you know, reach mainstream accessibility? Is it a design problem? Is it a reach problem? Is there a problem with the themes of the games?
Well, there's not a design problem. Certainly, we're seeing waves and waves of innovation. It's fantastic. It's a fantastic time to be a board gamer. I think in terms of reach, a lot of the companies that are bringing these games out are kind of small companies, one or two person operations in some cases, and there just isn't the opportunity for them to get the word out through established means. There's no TV campaigns, there's no big advertising campaigns in newspapers or magazines. What you do have is this online community that just lets people build this word of mouth buzz, and when you have a fantastic product and people are enthusiastic about it, that snowballs.
Well, a million thanks to all my guests, Ellie Gibson, Will Freeman and Owen Duffy. We'll have links to all our guest sites and to some of the board games and board gaming communities mentioned on this podcast on the blog for it. But from me, Alex Hearn, always the race car, and our producer Jason Phipps, always the hat, thanks for listening. Tune in next week and goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.